Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we talk cephalopods, a family of marine animals that includes octopuses, squid, cuttlefish, and nautilus. Joining us is Marine Biological Laboratory senior scientist and cephalopod researcher, Roger Hanlon. Welcome back. It's been a while.
Yeah, good morning, Mindy. It's really great to be back.
Yeah. So interest in octopuses is on the rise, maybe in part because of the Academy Award-winning documentary, My Octopus Teacher, and the recent National Geographic Disney series, Secrets of the Octopus. The octopus and other cephalopods captured your interest way before all of that, though. So what led to you, your career studying these creatures?
I really got interested as an undergraduate going to school in Florida, and I went on a snorkeling trip and encountered this octopus just by pure chance. And I swam over it, and it blew water in my stomach, scared the daylights out of me. I came out of the water and circled around and watched it for a few moments. I couldn't really find it, and it suddenly appeared and moved and disappeared and moved and disappeared. The camouflage was exquisite. I was just captured right away, and I'm still trying to figure out exactly how that works.
Yeah, you've been studying them all these years, learned a lot, but still a lot of questions. So what do you think it is of recent years that people have gotten so interested in octopuses?
Well, first of all, they're amazing, but they're weird. Mm-hmm. And I think that weirdness is really good. It drives different questions. It gets the public's interest. It's such an odd body form, and they do such unusual things. But people are realizing the capabilities of these animals are really beyond what we recognized all along the line. And it's all coming out now. They're definitely in vogue. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of media attention. And one of the things I'm really happy about is the exceptional, almost an exponential growth in research on octopuses and other cephalopods. And so I've been doing this for a long time. I've never seen this level of interest scientifically. So This means there are going to be more advances, more understanding of these animals.
Right. So let's talk about some of the attributes that make them so unique. You mentioned their brains. They have these huge brains, right? And very complex behavior. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's an evolving and important evolutionary story. You know, an octopus is related, most closely related to a clam and an oyster. They're mollusks. But through time, evolutionary time, they have evolved very, very differently. They've gotten rid of that external shell, and they've created a nervous system and sensory capabilities in this amazing brain over time because they're competing in the ocean with all of the fishes, which are winning the oceans at the moment. And so it's that selective pressure on the animals that have driven them to evolve this amazing skin so they can have dynamic camouflage. But these are animals that are thinking, cogitating, decision-making all of the time. And they're doing it on a level comparable to birds and even, you know, higher vertebrates that are doing things that we think were purely the province of those animals. And here we have a marine invertebrate competing with them and doing equally sophisticated things. So that brain is complicated to produce complex behavior.
Mm. Let's talk about the changing of color, right? Is it just octopuses, or are other cephalopods able to do this as well?
All of the cephalopods do this, except for the ancient nautilus. It doesn't change color. Mm-hmm. But squids, octopuses, cuttlefishes, they all have this dynamic camouflage. But it's not just for camouflage. They're changing their appearance either for defense, that's mainly camouflage, but also to communicate with one another. And so they've evolved this skin that is a key instrument in everything they do. You can't divorce the animal from its appearance. They're using their appearance to frighten a predator once they're discovered, or not to be discovered at all by the predator, but also to signal with one another. Squids, cuttlefishes, octopuses, when it comes time for mating and courtship, or males competing for females, they're using these color displays dynamically to convey their intentions and, you know, whether or not they can win that fight or gain that mate or evade that predator. So it's all controlled directly from the brain, and it's the fastest color change on planet Earth.
I was just going to say it happens like instantly, right?
It is literally as fast as 100 milliseconds. That's 1/10 of 1 second. And
wow.
So this is faster than a butterfly wing or a human eye blink. Now, you have to have a nervous system to generate super speed, and these are ultra-fast changes.
Are there animals that are able to do that, or is it just the cephalopods?
Lots of animals change color, and some of the
like chameleons, yeah.
Well, chameleons are the classic situation. Chameleons are relatively slow changers. They do it by hormonal change.
Mm.
Just a few chameleons can do a faster change, maybe in just a few seconds, but nothing competes with the sub-second change that the cephalopods have. And a few of the bony teleost fishes, like groupers, a few of them can change fast by a different mechanism. But the cephs have got it in this case.
And so their different colors mean different things. It could be like mating, it could be hunting, it could be hiding, right? So
yes, it's a visual language.
Yeah.
It's a nonverbal communication system is how we often couch that.
Okay, the other thing, octopuses can regenerate limbs. What do we know about how they do this, and what questions still remain about that?
There's actually very little known about it, except that they can do it really well. In some cases, an octopus in particular, think about how it really lives in nature. They're moving around on a coral reef or a kelp forest or a seagrass bed, and they're searching potential food spots with hidden prey like crabs and shrimps and fishes. So they're taking those eight arms, and they're reaching down blindly. They can't see what they're touching and feeling. All of those eight arms are doing a lot of things, partly on their own and partly in coordination. And so what if there's an eel down there? You know, those arms go in there, and an eel like to eat octopuses, so they'll nip off an arm or two. And that's where the regeneration comes in to be very important.
Yeah. So does our understanding of how octopuses regenerate limbs get us any closer to helping humans who have lost limbs or the use of limbs?
Yes. The octopuses have a system in their skin that enables this regeneration. It's like axolotls, you know, which are vertebrate animals that are used for models too. And there are researchers even at the MBL who are looking at this process, trying to understand what is happening at the molecular and cellular level that allows this regrowth, this regeneration of muscles and nerves and sensory neurons just the right way so that the animal has that functionality. Now, the octopus is a very short-lived animal, so they can't wait a long time. They need that fast growth to get the function back in that arm. So that perhaps one of the driving forces.
Yeah.
Your typical octopus only lives a year or less.
Wow.
Yes, there's a lot of misconception about these.
I thought it was at least I knew they were short-lived, but I didn't realize they were that short-lived.
The only exception is the giant Pacific octopus, mm-hmm. which lives off the Pacific Northwest, and that's very cold water, and they get very large. They might live 2 or 3 years.
Mm.
But your average octopus, and there are 300 of them on planet Earth that we know about, they're all living 6 to 12 months.
Wow. So there's a lot of things that the octopus does that would be of great help to humans, right? We're talking about limbs, we're talking about changing colors. And I'm just thinking about developing artificial intelligence. We hear a lot about that now. Is that some of your research being used in that area?
Surprisingly, it is. And I've given several talks, different venues, and point out that through evolutionary time, if you look at the development of brains, and we have a very complicated brain, maybe the most complicated brain on the planet. So the trajectory through evolutionary time of the vertebrate brain has been very heavily studied. Along that evolutionary line, we're talking way back many hundreds of millions of years, only one animal group took what I call a sharp left turn and developed a body and a brain very differently, and also produced complex behavior. And it happens to be the cephalopods, squid, octopus, and cuttlefish. And so they produce complex behavior, and so do vertebrates, but they were only together way back in evolutionary time. So what about this different evolutionary path? Can we learn something from that? And does it actually have a different architecture of its brain to produce complex behavior? And so when I give these talks to large audiences, I get the AI people coming and following me around and going, you mentioned that maybe that's another model for AI, because the AI people tend to say, we want more than one model, a human brain, for this. And they follow me around. They say, yes, we do want another model. We hope this works out, that you and your fellow scientists can actually prove that these animals have a different architecture of the brain that still produces complex behavior. Mm. And that's one of the big blue sky questions that we're all looking at for the future.
Yeah. And, you know, you look at them, they're just, as you said, alien looking, right? You've got all these eight arms, you've got that big brain head, and their head is really in a different spot than we think it is. Is that right?
Well, cephalopod means head foot.
Head
they
foot.
Have their head on their feet or their feet on their head. And so, yes, Benny Hockner in Israel really described this beautifully. He's a very famed neuroscientist. He calls it embodiment. You have to understand animals, including ourselves, and how we're built and act. You have to look at what's connected to what. So we don't have our head connected to our our feet, but the octopus does. So if you look at that embodiment and you think about how the brain has to be structured to coordinate those two in a different place, then you begin to see that the nervous system is constructed differently for that particular mm-hmm. arrangement of the body and the brain. So this helps us understand how all those eight arms work and how they're coordinated. We don't have to worry about eight arms.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should. We could do a lot more things.
Talk about multitasking, right?
They can multitask. I hope we talk about that.
Yeah.
So this is really a big issue, and there's a lot of attention given to that right now.
And you know, you mentioned that they're not long-lived, but they're also so vulnerable, right? I mean, they are prey to a lot of things, and I mean, again, they don't have the shell or a lot of the protection. I mean, the camouflage is a lot of times their only protection. So talk about their vulnerability.
Well, they are very vulnerable, but you know, they can actually swim very fast, mm-hmm. and they do some other really cool tricks. Now, first of all, the camouflage is extravagant. I've done a lot of work on these animals in the field. They can move around on a coral reef, which is the most complicated visual arrangement on planet Earth, and instantly change color in hundreds of backgrounds. So that's pretty good by itself.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when camouflage fails? They use that color and pattern and skin and their brain to make a decision to flash a bright color to startle the predator who's about to attack. This is secondary defense. And then they ink in its face and jet away really fast. That's part of what this body can do. You don't think an octopus can swim fast, but they are jet propelled and they can do it. And then the final thing they do in that circumstance is they do the old fake right, go left trick that we call it, which is they're swimming in the distance. The predator might be chasing them and they'll ink off to the right. They'll blanch, jet to the bottom, and in 100 milliseconds camouflage. And so your eye is drawn to the black bit that goes in the water column to the right, that's the fake right, and then they go left, they're transparent and camouflaged. This is just one of many examples we've learned by doing the field work in particular.
Yeah.
They're clever.
What do you think are some of the more common misconceptions about octopuses?
Well, I think one of the biggest ones, which is common these days, is that they form strong emotions with humans. This, I think, is a misconception. In fact, I'm sure it is. I'm trained as an ethologist. We look subjectively and get data on how they can communicate. But I think the misconception is that they're so well tuned in to humans, like in an aquarium. In truth, what they're doing is they're using what senses they have to touch a human or look at a human and figure out what it is. The same as they do to conspecifics or other animals, other octopuses they meet underwater. So I think that's one thing. The other is that there are some suggestions that octopuses play or that they have really high level consciousness. These things we have no data on yet. There are some publications on it, but you know, they're not empirical, they're not controlled. And so I think we have to learn a little bit more about what they're actually doing before we extrapolate, which humans do all the time, and they put it in human terms. Mm. So, you know, they're fascinating animals. Let's appreciate what they do so well.
Yeah. And we have this, we want to make them human-like. It's not just the octopuses. It's lots of different animals that we do that to. We put human traits to. What are we potentially missing by doing that?
Well, I think we miss some of the sophisticated things they do. This is why I spent so much time underwater studying animals in the natural environment, because there you're immersed in their sensory world. And if you now understand the hearing and tasting and visual capabilities of those animals and what they can do that you can't do and what they can't do, it really helps you understand their behavior. And I think that is key for conservation or fisheries management or anything, is to understand what each of these animals can and can't do. In the case of an octopus, everyone that has that doleful eye that really attracts people, and that eye is so different from ours. It's a big eye and it has good visual acuity. It can see really well at night and we can't. It can't see color. They're colorblind. So how do they achieve colorblind camouflage? We still don't know. And they can see polarization, which is really bizarre. We can't see the polarization aspect of light. So once you understand a little bit of what that octopus sees and doesn't see, you can understand its behavior better, and you can understand its ecological niche and what it's doing with predator and prey. You can also exploit any one of these things in a human way. For example, if you want to understand how the animal camouflages on different backgrounds, which is something that we study, then you can understand a lot about how to quantify camouflage. And if you want to produce camouflage for humans, for hunters, for example, you can inform them about how to interpret a background and put the right camouflage pattern on. These animals are doing it with fast decision-making all the time. Humans have no capability of doing that, as one example.
Yeah. We're talking about cephalopods this morning, in particular octopuses, with Marine Biological Laboratory senior scientist and cephalopod researcher Roger Hanlon. It's been a lot we've learned in the last few years, and we're going to talk about that after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking cephalopods this morning, a family of marine animals that includes octopuses, squid, cuttlefish, and nautilus. With us is Marine Biological Laboratory senior scientist and cephalopod researcher Roger Hanlon. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you have a comment or a question. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we've learned a lot in the last few years. You talked about the amount of research that's kind of picked up. Let's start with their suckers. What are we learning about their suckers?
Well, an octopus has 8 arms. Everyone knows that. What people don't realize is that each arm has 100 to 200 suckers, and each sucker has about 10,000 neurons in it. So we're talking about heavily innervated suckers. So what does a sucker do? Yes, it sucks. It grasps. It's an organ very important for that. But this is perhaps one of the most important parts of an octopus, because they do chemical and mechanical sensing with each of those suckers. And so there's a lot of chemical information they can obtain by touching things. In fact, their chemical abilities enable them to distinguish prey versus non-prey when they're blindly feeding underwater. And we've done parallel experiments in the laboratory showing exactly how precise that chemical sensing is. Same with the mechanical sensing. You know, is it soft, is smooth? Can they really distinguish things with the suckers alone? And they definitely can, but it's not as good as the chemical sensing. And so here's another example. When an octopus meets another octopus underwater, that's an unusual event. These are mostly solitary animals. And I and others have filmed this underwater, and it's really interesting. You can see even octopuses of the same species, they cannot recognize the sex of each other until they touch each other with the suckers. They're actually identifying the sex of a different individual of the same species by touching the suckers and taking that chemical information and making that decision. And when they touch the suckers of another octopus of a different species, it's beautiful to watch the video, because they touch each other and they instantly jet off 30 meters in the other direction. It is the most dramatic response you can imagine.
Yeah.
So the suckers, you know, I glibly described an octopus arm as a device that delivers the octopuses somewhere to do some work. And that's how important the suckers are. You know, I make the analogy, the sucker of an octopus is sort of like a combination combination of the human nose, lips, tongue, and finger.
All in one.
All wrapped up in one.
Yeah, wow.
So next time you see an octopus, or God forbid you're eating one, yeah, that sucker has got some interesting capabilities. It's a beautiful organ.
Yeah. One thing I want to talk about suckers is, you know, we didn't talk about their capability of getting into these really small spaces. Mm-hmm. And we often hear stories of octopuses who they think have left the aquarium tank, gone over somewhere else, gotten into some trouble and come back to the aquarium tank. But there would be evidence of that because of the suckers. Suckers on dry land, not such a good thing, right?
That doesn't work. Some of those stories, yes, the stories are true. Octopuses will escape their tank in a laboratory if they're not happy. And they can move along over different surfaces, wet or dry. But they pay a dear price for that because the suckers have a cuticle that gets replaced almost every day, sort of like a fingernail analogy. And when they move across a wet surface, it can stay intact fairly well. But on a dry surface, that cuticle will get pulled off. Mm. And so they get a secondary infection from that. So what they never tell you in these stories on the internet or the newspaper or whatever is what happened 2 or 3 days later, in which case, because we've seen this happen from time to time, the octopus gets secondary infections and it can really harm the animal dramatically.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about what we've learned about sleep.
Yeah, this is really amazing. There have been 2 or 3 really landmark papers in the last just 2 or 3 years. An octopus spends 80 to 90% of its time hiding in a den because it's a soft-bodied animal. It has to go out to find food every day, so they do that. And so what are they doing in that den all that time? You know, well, part of the time, they're sleeping. Folks have been able to put electrodes and cameras on their den and look at their ventilation rate and all the rest. And we sort of assume that they've been sleeping, but we don't know much beyond that. Well, now 2 studies have been accomplished in the lab where they've put electrodes in the brain and they've had the animals under dark conditions and they videotaped them under infrared light. And it's absolutely stunning. You see the animals every once in a while. They have the quiet sleep, which is typical, like humans have, but they have this active sleep period too. And when the active sleep period kicks in, these animals start twitching their muscles. They start flashing colors and patterns. And the eyes, actually, you can see the eyes squint and twist around and move around. It's rapid eye movement, if ever there was, just like humans and a lot of animals. And so they're showing all these traits of what we would call dreaming. And it's very hard to prove dreaming.
I can't tell you.
Yeah, well, but, you know, it's interesting because the skin coloration is that visual communication system I talked about. And when these animals are changing during that dreaming, it's not coordinated into typical things, just like our dreams are seldom reality. They don't fit. They're just bits and pieces jumbled together and cobbled together for a dream. And that's what those patterns are looking like. But in the cuttlefish or octopus, we can actually, since we know that it's direct neural control from the brain and we know which part of the brain is doing that, that's more than we can do with humans at the moment to really trace this back where in the brain these neurons are firing and whether or not the firing sequence is really different.
And no wonder the AI guys are following you around.
Hang on.
Right?
Let's see what comes out of this in the future, because this is a brand new finding. And it's really illuminating, so to speak, because we're seeing this dramatic play out of behavior in a sleeping octopus. And these are really well-done papers published in Nature and other high journals. So we're very excited to see this development.
Yeah. So what are you finding in the differences of studying octopuses and other cephalopods in the lab versus in the wild? Are there differences there?
There are differences. And one of the reasons I do a lot of field work is that I want to be able to understand natural behavior versus artifact. And so you bring an animal into the laboratory, it's a totally different world for that animal, depending on how you arrange your laboratory. Our laboratory environment and our studies are all geared to what we've learned in nature that they need for habitat, lighting, and food. So it cuts that transition problem down. But really, we need to understand, because most people can do the studies in the lab, we need to know what's artifact and what isn't. Because really, when you're studying the nervous system, you want to be sure that you're studying normal behaviors, natural behaviors, and not influencing them in an unusual way. So, you know, I think it's important for all animal models that we be able to do that. And, you know, this is done to a large extent. And I think that's probably my take on that.
What about, what are we learning about memory?
A lot. And octopuses were the first animal model in the 1950s and 60s where learning and memory were really studied comprehensively. This was mainly in Naples, Italy. And the findings in those years were that these animals have short-term and long-term memory, and it's a very elegant system. Recently, there's been study not so much on octopus but on cuttlefish, which are, you know, similar to octopuses in many ways, showing something, for example, called episodic-like memory. This is a much more sophisticated sort of memory. It's the what, where, and when of a learning event. And so it takes human children 4 years of brain development to be able to do episodic-like memory, where you see something and you know when you saw it and where you saw it and how you saw it. And then later you have to take those three variables and scramble them around in different ways to find that again and use it. That's what episodic-like memory is in its essence. And so octopuses seem to have this. They almost certainly do. There's just a really elegant study done this year. They took seven octopuses, this is in Italy, and gave them this episodic-like memory task, and then they gave them a week off to see if the memory retention was there. Then they put the animals back in different situations where they could use that information to find a prey in a different place in a different time. And they assumed that all these animals would try to do that. Well, guess what? Nothing of the sort. One animal used episodic-like memory to solve the task, and the other six characters went off and took off different tactics completely to solve the solution. And the title of the paper is Unruly Octopuses Rule. I love that title. Because what it indicates is the, let's say, the brain diversity, capabilities, and adaptability that they can be put into a new situation, and they don't have just one way to solve that problem. They have multiple ways. This, to me, is a good indication of high-level cognition and abilities in the brain. I don't like that word intelligence. Yes, it's octopus intelligence, but, you know, we can find different terms. They're doing decision-making, but they're making changes as they go. And so they're taking that memory and they're using it in different ways. So this is really more evidence that these animals are, you know, quite advanced.
You know, everybody is interested in brain science. We talk about human brains, but boy, oh boy, when you start looking at the octopus brain and then start, like, even the just the sleep comparisons and stuff, this is really fascinating stuff.
It really is. And looking at that brain architecture, our lab has teamed up recently with Penn State University and University of Chicago. And what we're doing is we're doing really detailed scans of a whole octopus, its brain, its muscles, its peripheral nerves, and all the rest. And by the way, the brain has 80 million neurons in it, but they have 300 million neurons in the rest of their body and their arms. So they have a distributed nervous system unlike other animals. But getting back to the imaging, we're trying to work out the connectome. What are all the connections of the neurons in the brain down to each of the eight arms? How much do adjacent arms communicate with each other without using the brain? And we know they do that. Well, how do they do it? And what's the neural diagram that we can do to make a soft robotic arm that we can use in medicine or for crush buildings or whatever? And, you know, the U.S. Navy and many other agencies would like to have soft, flexible robotic arms, which are really are not available these days. The octopus is the premier model for this right now.
Wow. Talk a little bit about linking brain to ecology. There's, a study out of a landmark paper out of Australia on this.
Yes. This is currently my favorite paper. I know the authors very well. And what they did was they took a wide range of cephalopods, octopuses in this case. Octopuses, they're not all as sophisticated as different species. Some are a little duller than others. Some are a little more sophisticated. But they took the field work where they could say this animal has a more limited color change capability and it lives in a duller environment and it doesn't feed on as many things. And then he took a whole series of animals, 7 or 8 of them, to more complex backgrounds so that they could relate the complexity of the animal and its color change and its behavior to the ecology. Then they went back and they looked at individual items that the animal could do and compared them all. Then they looked at the brain and they looked at the vertical lobe of the brain, which is the learning and memory center of the octopus. And they found that in the complicated environments, these animals had 7 divisions of the vertical lobe, whereas the ones that were in sort of the less complex, even boring environments had only 5 or even 3. Mm. So they were relating that key brain structure to ecological complexity. And so they went right from the brain all the way up to behavior and ecology. And it's just so data-rich, that study, that it just, I really admired that kind of work. It's groundbreaking.
Fascinating. Do cuttlefish have the same kind of lifespan as octopuses?
They do, yes. Very
so all cephalopods are short-lived?
The squids are even shorter.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Squids are 6 to 9 months, and they're a foot long.
Yeah. Wow. We're talking with Marine Biological Laboratory Senior Scientist and Cephalopod Researcher Roger Hanlon. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have comments or questions. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking cephalopods this morning, a family of marine mammals that includes octopuses, squid, cuttlefish, and nautilus. And with us is Marine Biological Laboratory Senior Scientist and Cephalopod Researcher Roger Hanlon. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before we get back to it, some people go octopi, octopuses. It is octopuses, right?
It is octopuses because it's a Greek derivative word, not Latin. So if it were a Latin word, you would say octopi, but that's grammatically wrong. So octopuses or octopodes, which no one wants to say. So let's just stick with octopuses, you know, not octopi.
I was at the Science Museum over the weekend, and I saw they had octopi. We need to let them know they got it wrong,
shame,
right?
Shame.
All right, so tell us about the courtship of the octopus on the Great Barrier Reef.
Well, one of the big questions for all animals is, what is their reproductive system? How do they get their genes to the next generation? And so those of us who have studied reproduction in octopus have really found a system very different from squids and cuttlefishes, both of which have extravagant systems with courtship and mating and males fighting, and they have very elaborate mating systems. The octopus has, in general, a less elaborate reproductive system, and we really haven't seen courtship. Basically, as I mentioned earlier, any octopus in the ocean is seldom running into another octopus. And when they do, they better be thinking sex because they're not going to have more chances. And so this is true. And we know that when they do successfully mate in the wild, the females can store sperm the rest of their life. So they really only have to have one encounter. But now, what gets communicated when there's more than one person involved, one person, one octopus. And so our understanding so far has been that we know a lot about how octopuses mate and lay eggs, but the courtship part of it and competition among males competing for a female really was only seen briefly in one small species in the Indo-Pacific. So last year when we were filming a part of the Secrets of the Octopus on the Great Barrier Reef, I was able to, for 6 days straight, watch Octopus cyanea, which is the day octopus. I think sort of the king of camouflage, really, and one of the most elaborate octopuses out there. And these animals were, there were many animals in one area, which we've almost never seen. It was shallow water. And so we could approach them and watch them for hours at a time. And what we found was really a surprise. Females would go to a certain perch each day, and the females would go feeding and they'd come back to their perch, and then they'd go back to their den and hide all night. Well, there were other males around. There were 4 to 5 males around who also were watching the female. And we hadn't really seen this in an underwater venue before. And then it got even more interesting because we noticed that one male would go up and sort of begin to approach the female. And what we expected to see was just mating more or less right away. Instead, he would back off and go around, and then he'd jet to another area and pick a fight with another male that he could see at a distance. And so the males were competing actively, and the fights, one of which is on that TV program, are violent. Imagine 16 arms wrapped all around each other, and they have a beak which can bite, and they have a poison in the beak, so they can really do damage, and they can suffocate each other. So the fights are serious fights. So back to courtship. We're watching these animals day after day, and I was able to film this whole sequence where this male had a fight with another male, came up to the female in a big coral head and spent like 30 or 40 minutes moving around the coral head, sticking his head up and peeking to the female, and then ducking and moving around, then coming up and showing his whole body and putting a dramatic pattern on, then moving around another part. It was like a dance. And then at the end, he came around and got onto the top of the coral head, maybe, a meter away, and slowly but surely crawled towards her. Just where he got about arm's length away, and then he took his third right arm, which is the arm that transfers the spermatophore, which is a long white kind of granule or tube with sperm in it, but that's hidden. He uncurls this arm in the most elaborate way, uncurls it towards the female, watching to see if she accepts it or not, because when other males would do it, the female would just spit at him and they'd jet away. This time, let the guy uncurl his arm, put it into her mantle cavity, into the oviduct, and then I was able to film the spermatophore being transferred. So that was a successful mating.
Don't get many opportunities like that, do you?
This all took a lot of time. Yeah. These animals are now exposed to predation. They're sitting right on top of a coral head. You could see them, a long way off. And so they're taking this gamble and going through this elaborate ritual. And now that's not all that happened. The female then, what we saw the next day, was another elaborate behavior, which is not courtship. I will call it anti-courtship.
Uh-oh.
Because now another male approached her. And so what happened was, as she's watching this other male, a meter away, suddenly I see her wiggle her 8 arms, and then she takes 3 of her arms and plops them up through her mantle and sticks them out of her funnel, her breathing funnel. And I can see these tips, and all of a sudden she blows out all these little white tips, which are stored spermatophores from a previous mating. So she has actually looked at a courting male now, and she's decided to get rid of some previous sperm. This is called cryptic female choice.
Wow.
Which many animals do, it turns out. And so she's making these decisions. So this is like taking the courtship from the day before and blowing it away.
I like this guy better.
I like this guy better. So you see the sophistication of the system here. So what we witnessed in these 6 days was what I call sort of a full circle sexual system, where there's a discovery of, mature and receptive females, but they're very choosy, and the males really have to do some serious dancing and fighting to get to the female, and then they have to be accepted. So this is really changing our view of the sex life of the octopus, and it's an important part of the life cycle.
And once that's done, the male and female are not together anymore.
No, they don't stick together. The female then on her own lays eggs, and she grooms the eggs, and the males are nowhere around. That's true of all the cephalopods. There's no parental care.
Right. All right, so the mimic octopus has been reported to imitate up to a dozen animals, including shrimp, flounder, and jellyfish. How much research has been done in this species, and do we know if this behavior is innate or learned?
Not enough research is answer number one. There are only four papers published on
this. Oh, only four. Wow.
Yes. Three of them are out of our lab. We spent a lot of time in Indonesia and in Florida. There is a Florida mimic octopus, by the way. Mm. Most people look at it and they think it's only in the Pacific, in Indo-Pacific. Here's the story. These animals live out in a moonscape. They live in these flat, open plains, not on the coral at all, not in the seagrass or anything. So they're out there and they're totally exposed. These are these long-arm octopuses, and they have adapted to the sand environment. But when they have to swim a distance out in the open, they're going to be seen by predators. So what do they do? Do they want to look like an octopus swimming in the open? Probably not. And so this is how the mimic octopus was discovered by recreational divers. And what they do all the time is they take their eight arms, which look like a radial arrangement like the spokes on a bicycle, and they fold them all back and they swim with their head forward and their two eyes, and they drape their arms behind them in the shape of a flounder. And they actually... And they move their body like a flounder movement, like a flounder swimming. And it looks so much like a flounder that our divers, our research divers, were mistaking them for flounders. And this was the first mimicry that was noticed. The first paper that came out on this, you see this octopus can contort its body in all kinds of different ways. So they made some guesses, not scientific observations or quantification of this, and said maybe it looks like a scorpionfish, and maybe it looks like this, and maybe it looks like that. There are no data. We haven't been able to accumulate any data on all those other things like sea snakes and all the rest, but we were able to see 500 episodes of flounder mimicry in a single week of diving. So they're doing this all the time. So that's a mimicry we know about absolutely for sure. Now, there's more to learn about this animal. I'm not saying they don't mimic other animals.
We just don't know.
But we don't have any data, and as an empirical scientist, wouldn't we like to have real data?
Yeah.
And so
I'm just thinking back to your luck in when you were just out of school and dive snorkeling and seeing this octopus. And there's so many people go like, I would love to see an octopus. But it's not as easy as it sounds, right? I mean, you're very lucky if you come across one and actually spot it, right?
How do you find an octopus?
How do you find the camouflage? How do you? So if somebody's wanting to see one, what are your tips?
Well, the first tip is go to a public aquarium.
Yeah, you can see them in an aquarium. But yeah, out in the wild, it's hard, right?
In the wild, it's very difficult. To find an animal that's out foraging, they don't stay camouflaged every moment because sometimes when they move, you can pick up their movement. You have to have a sharp eye. To find them when they're camouflaged, I lose them all the time. But here's a trick for someone who really wants to do the work and the divers. We can find the dens of an octopus. And now some octopuses have conspicuous dens. They'll go back to maybe a few days at a time, and then they'll move. But you can see those dens, and we'll mark them. And then we'll come back at dawn with diving groups, and we'll just watch that den from a distance until the octopus sort of wakes up from its dreaming and looks around. And if the coast is clear, they'll go and they'll start foraging. Now, if the divers are there and they don't move and they're at a distance, the octopus will habituate to their presence over time, maybe 5 minutes, might be 20 minutes, and they'll start to forage and you can follow them. And that's the best way to do that. But most recreational divers don't have that much patience. Some of the photographers do. But I encourage people to do that because if you take the time, you're now going to see some of these exquisite behaviors. And once the octopus allows you to get near it, it's determined that you are not a threat.
Right.
And so they will let you hang around. And this is the trick that we use underwater all the time.
Yeah.
So you can do it, but it's
time-consuming. Yeah. Marianne writes, thank you for this fascinating discussion. During their short, complex lives, do octopuses have brain developmental stages as humans do?
Half the octopuses do and half don't. So what do I mean by that? About half of the octopus species lay just relatively few eggs, maybe 300 eggs, which is not many. And each octopus hatches out as a miniature adult. And the brain is fully formed and ready to roll. So in that case, no. But the other half of the 300 octopuses, roughly, they lay 10, 20, 30,000 teeny tiny little eggs that produce what we call a paralarva. It's a real larval form. It looks like a tiny squid. And they go out into the plankton for weeks on end. And, you know, they get preyed upon very heavily. But those animals, their brain structure is extremely different and limited. So there is brain development in those octopuses that have that larval stage. And as that brain develops and they get a little bit bigger, they then become an octopus. They settle to the bottom. So there is a, you know, a major divide there in some of those species. But we don't know, you know, how do you even collect those larval planktonic octopuses and study them? No one's done that. Yeah. So to all you young PhD students out there who want to do it, there's a project.
Yeah, exactly. All right, some cephalopods can produce bioluminescence. What do we know about the purpose or use of the bioluminescence for these creatures?
Well, these are visual animals, and there are a lot of octopuses and other fishes and other animals that live below the photic zone, that is roughly below 900 feet or 300 meters. Sunlight doesn't penetrate deeper than that. And many of the octopuses live down there in that environment. And like other animals there, they do have visual communication with bioluminescence. They have photophores in their skin that produce bioluminescent light, and they have eyes that can detect that bioluminescence, which is a weak blue-green color. And so we do know that the bioluminescence, for example, we all know that an octopus can ink, you know. Well, they can ink in that environment, and they mix in the bioluminescence with the ink, so they actually blow out a bioluminescent ink cloud to deceive a predator. That's one of the reasons that they use the bioluminescence. The other is for determining species to species, finding another octopus to mate with, and they have a signaling system there to tell male from female, we think. Some of the female bioluminescent patterns are different from the males. And so this hasn't been observed in real time that you'd want sequences of behavior, but it looks like they're using the bioluminescence for quite a few things.
I know this is like asking your favorite child, but do you have a favorite octopus?
I do.
You do? Okay.
I do. It's I do like most of them, maybe all of them. But yeah, it's that Pacific octopus, the day octopus, Octopus cyanea, which lives on the most complicated coral reefs on the planet. You know, the center of marine bioradiation is in, you know, the sort of Indonesia area. And that animal, which we've studied all over the Western Pacific and throughout Indonesia and so forth, everything it does is the most complicated and the most sophisticated. So that's my favorite for sure.
Still a lot to learn. And of course, we didn't even mention the giant squid, right? I mean, wouldn't you love to be able to get more info on that?
Well, you know, a few years ago, the first giant squid was actually landed by Dr. Kubadera in Japan, a colleague of mine. So they actually got a giant squid in the boat. And so it turns out that we've learned a lot from that specimen. Turns out that it's not sort of a flaccid, not very fast squid. It's strong as can be. It has these magnificent eyes. And so it's not like, you know, the Loch Ness Monster. This is the real thing, where they do live at 5,000 feet, so it's a little hard to find.
Yeah.
But there's so much more to learn about. There's so many deep sea squids.
Oh, yeah.
You know, sperm whales feed exclusively on squids. How many squids can be down there?
I know. Well, you know, the other thing, speaking of that Disney, The Secret of Octopuses, at the very end, there's an interview James Cameron has with Alex, the scientist that's featured in that. And she asks him about, you know, going down in the dark right below the 900 meters. And he mentions the Dumbo octopus. They had video of it. What a fascinating, it looks like it has Dumbo ears, but I guess they're actually fins. But what an interesting creature that is.
They are fins, and when you see the picture of them, it does look like Dumbo the elephant with the big elephant ears.
Yeah.
What do we know about them? Practically nothing. It's so hard to encounter them. The folks at Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, MBARI, they've gotten some good information on them, as have other groups. So we're slowly but surely learning what's happening in the deep sea even.
Yeah. Lots of questions answered and still lots of questions asked. With every one you find the answer to, you've got, what, three or four more.
Yeah. The more we learn, the more we understand that we're ignorant about most things.
Marine Biological Laboratory Senior Scientist and Cephalopod Researcher Roger Hanlon. Roger, thanks so much for coming in. And we'll look forward to hearing your updates in the future as you learn more.
My pleasure, Mindy. Thanks again.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.